people say, you do what? Philosopher of the environment? And I mean, what is it? Well, we think about the environment. So that's kind of what I do. But I thought the way to do these little stops would be to get us into some of the conversations that I have on This Stop Wildlife. And, you know, I'll tell you some of the words we use and some of the things we say, and, you know, you might find them really engaging or you might find them really boring. But that's okay, because at the next two stops, we'll be in different conversations. So on this first one, what sort of conversation would an environmental philosopher get in on the topic of wildlife and why we should value wildlife? So rumor has it somebody has seen a white wolf on this property here or hereabouts, not mentioning any names or pointing to any places where
animal
might have been seen. But if you are an environmental philosopher or an environmental ethicist, and somebody asked you, why do you value a white wolf? What would you say? Before I give you my answer, what would you say if somebody said, why do you value this white wolf?
Uniqueness.
It's unique.
Simply beautiful and fascinating.
Beautiful to look at. Fascinating to look at.
You won't see it every day.
Very rare. There's like a rarity is like a value enhancer. Does a photographer want to say anything about the wolf offers?
For one thing, the fact that I assume it's an albino, if it's purely white, and albinos do not fare very well normally because they are so visible, they're easily avoided. And so if one can live up here and survive up here, it's a testimony to kind of leaping back 100 years or so when wolves were still really wild. And that's the wonder of having a large open area like this. I love to come up here and take pictures.
Mm-hmm. So taking pictures is a reason to value a white wolf. It just gives a lot of pleasure to someone to take these pictures. So, okay, the philosopher, the environmental philosopher is listening to these answers. And the environmental philosopher says, I can detect two different ways of valuing this wolf. So one of the ways is to value it in terms of the joy, the excitement, the interest, the photographic possibilities, the historical knowledge, the sort of ability to reminisce about what things used to be like in the past. All of these ways of thinking about the wolf come through the person. So it's like when the person sees the wolf, they feel this, or they get excited in this way, or they are sort of motivated in some sort of way. And that's a perfectly legitimate way, philosophically, to value an animal like a wolf. Comes through the person.
Another one then, as you're talking, it would be the value of its place in the ecosystem and how it maintains other...
Yeah, so this other way would be not to filter it through the person, but to somehow filter it through something non-human. And a lot of environmental philosophers think, actually, when you're doing real environmental philosophy, you're filtering it not through the person. I mean, that's fine, but you're filtering it through something else. So one possibility is you say the ecosystem, and you say, you know, this wolf is fantastic because of the way it belongs in this ecosystem, the way it trims the herd, the way it shapes the landscape. And you've probably heard all these stories about the Yellowstone wolves, and how the Yellowstone wolves literally shape the rivers. I mean, it's sort of amazing. You know, they shape the rivers because they move the elk around. When the elk are moved around, you know, the riparian vegetation grows, the beavers come back, the beavers flood the rivers, the channels change. So somehow the wolf is shaping the river. So that's a different way an environmental ethicist might proceed. Is they might say, well, the wolf has this role in the bigger system. But there's another way I want to add too, like a third possible way, which is to say, forget the people who enjoy the wolf. Forget the ecosystem that the wolf contributes to. Let's just think about the wolf. You know, like the wolf. We value the wolf for what it is in itself. And this language of in itself, you know, why do you value something in itself? This has become a real obsession for environmental philosophers. And so when you start to try and answer the question, why do you value the wolf in itself? You come up with things like, well, because it's alive. And just being alive is good in itself. Or it's intelligent, and having intelligence is good in itself. But I wanted to explore one answer to this question that I think is really, really interesting. And it might sort of springboard us on to other topics in the walk. Let's think about this wolf in itself. And let's go right inside the wolf, into its cell tissues, into the nucleus, and let's go right into the genome of that wolf. Okay, so we've shrunk ourselves way down here, and we're right inside the wolf's genome. And we look at that genome, and we say, what does that genome contain? Well, like any living creature that has a genome, that genome has instructions for the wolf as to how to live. It's a set of codes which essentially allow that wolf to grow up and become the kind of intelligent social predator that it is on the landscape. Like, that genome speaks something. That genome, you might say, is linguistic. And actually, you know, people who study genomes, you know, they note that genomes are made up of letters, A's, C's, T's, and G's. So, you know, literally, there is a language in a genome. And the genome has, if you like, a language of wisdom. Why does it have wisdom? Well, genomes have the shape they do because over many, many generations, that genome has become the thing that is required for that wolf to survive and prosper in the landscape. So the gene for a wolf that's kind of slow and doesn't avoid hazards, that one gets smacked out. You know, like the genome for the wolf that wasn't a very good hunter, that one disappears. The genome for the wolf that is sort of prone to foot disease or something, that one disappears. So the one that survives is the genome that has the wisdom in it. So now when you answer this question, well, why do we value the wolf? Well, what you're valuing is wisdom embedded in a genome. And what's interesting about that is you're valuing the wisdom embedded in the genome. You're not just valuing that one wolf, you're valuing the whole species. And this is great for environmental philosophers, right? Because environmental philosophers, they want to know how to value a whole species. And so by taking this argument into the genome and talking about the wisdom that's in the genome, you've suddenly magically stopped talking about just one wolf. And you've started talking about why the species itself is important, because there's something really special in that genome. So I have one more place I want to go with this, but I'm going to pause before going there, because that felt like a bit of a speech already, and I'm about 7 or 8 minutes into it already.
You are good. I wanted to add one thing. What you were just mentioning made me think of the idea of valuing one instance of justice and then valuing the whole concept or the whole contract of justice as well, and sort of looking at it in that sense.
Yeah.
Makes a lot of sense.
It's quite easy, in ethics, it's quite easy to value one thing, or I value this one thing because. It's much harder to say, well, I value this whole sweep of things for this reason. And I think that story about the genome allows you to do that.
What is disturbing about that philosophy, though, is if you generalize that out to humankind, then it becomes a little bit more scary, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Because those who are the most successful might be the most clever, not in a good sense. And where are we going as a society with that, which has scary implications?
And I think we've already kind of touched on that back in the 30s and the 40s with eugenics.
Yeah. So I'll tell you something very interesting about being an environmental philosopher is you find that a lot of the things you say with regards to the environment translate very uncomfortably over to humans? It's a really interesting question, because you would think one of the premises in, if you're an environmental philosopher, is that, well, humans are just part of nature anyway, and so anything that we want to say about nature, we should be able to say about humans. But you put your finger on something that's actually kind of worrying. If you sort of value the genetics of something, and then you might value the genetic purity. I mean, in the case of bison, as you know, in Montana, there's this big issue about which bison are genetically pure. And, you know, the Yellowstone ones really count because they are genetically pure. But you take that over into the human realm, and suddenly you're in a horrible conversation that you don't want to be in.
Right, like, well, look at the Native Americans. You have to be only a certain percentage in order to be considered a part
of
the tribe.
These are examples of where what you say about non-humans doesn't and perhaps shouldn't just translate right over into what you say about humans. And this is a kind of a puzzle for environmental philosophers, because you want to say humans are really
different. To mosquitoes.
Yeah.
People don't talk about mosquitoes the same way they talk about wolves.
Yeah. So I have this one.
Yeah. The difference between something so special as that wolf, the word I thought of was survivor, mm-hmm. and then I did transfer over to people. You know, at what point does it become a plague, or, you know, too much of anything is not a good thing, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. I mean, species will overpopulate, and, you know, they get their comeuppance. You know, they, mm-hmm. disease or starvation mm-hmm. or something like that. Humans have managed to sort of sidestep a lot of the issues of disease.
I appreciate what you said about the mosquitoes, because it kind of brings back the idea of filtering it through a human lens instead of through the...
Yeah.
It's weird, it's sort of happening at the same time. And but I think that wisdom that you're talking about with the wolf, that same genetic code is embedded in the mosquito too.
Yes.
So, and in us too. And so there's like this interconnectedness of all sorts of different... There's a lot of similarities in the genetic code between different species, you know.
Although even that, in a way, is sort of random, because you can think it's possibly the most well-adapted creature that ever lived might have lived during the Jurassic, and then when the asteroid hit, it was gone, and there was just no way to adapt. And so,
that's actually a really important point, I think, is that the wisest wolf that ever lived might have been born and eaten 5 minutes later. That's natural selection.
Yeah,
that's
a
massive part of natural selection. And so the ones that do survive, that's why evolution creeps along at such a slow pace.
Yeah.
And I'd submit that the difference between human and what we were just discussing is that we have become Lamarckian. We make the decisions. We consciously alter the environment. The rest of nature lives in what it's born into and survives as best it can. And
yeah.
That's the Darwinian selection and natural selection as opposed to Lamarckian selection, which is designed, decided, and why we evolve so fast.
So let me use that just to go into the one last piece I wanted to talk about at this stop, which I think is really interesting. This question of, well, how are humans different and why are humans so successful? I mean, if you think of what we've done to this landscape, how we've transformed everything, what's happening to our population, what is the difference? So one environmental philosopher a few years ago said, I got the answer to that question. The answer is, humans are different because non-humans can only transfer wisdom between generations in their genes. Humans, on the other hand, can write books, they can create libraries, they can create bodies of knowledge that get handed down. They have levels of communication that give them this capacity that non-humans don't have. So this was the environmental philosopher who said, this is actually the difference. If you're a non-human, information goes through the generations on your genes and no other way. If you're a human, yes, information goes through your genes, but it also goes through books and libraries and that sort of thing. And everybody said, well, that maybe that sounds kind of okay, and they went with it for a while. here's the thing. There was a study that came out. Some of you might have seen this. It came out maybe 4 or 5 months ago. And it was some University of Wyoming researchers who had tracked the movements of bighorn sheep and moose that had been reintroduced into areas they used to inhabit. And both of these species should, in those areas, move to follow the vegetation in the spring. They call it surfing the green wave. So, you know, things start to kind of green up, and these species should follow the greening of the vegetation. What these researchers found is that the animals that were reintroduced to these areas had no idea how to surf the green wave. They were just clueless. They were dropped in places, and they just sort of wandered around and munched a little bit and then kind of got hungry. Why did they not know how to surf the green wave? Do you know why?
Yeah. Well, I think it's because of teaching.
It's because there were no elders.
Mm-hmm. Right.
There was no cultural wisdom to be passed on.
But they had surfed the green wave from wherever they originated, right?
They presumably had some knowledge back from where they were translocated from, but that knowledge was no good in this new area. This was a new area, so they didn't really know where to go or what to do. And so these researchers compared species that were reintroduced from species that were actually, you know, there already or nearby, and a dramatic difference. Now, slowly, the reintroduced species could relearn how to surf the green wave. But it was only through multiple generations. And they tried to extrapolate how many generations would you actually need. And the answer they came up with was, with a bighorn sheep, you need about 60 years before you have the cultural wisdom again. With a moose, you need about 100 years to surf the green wave. So why, I mean, it's just kind of interesting for what it is, but it's also interesting for this discussion about the difference between humans and animals. Mm-hmm. Because some people think, well, only humans have cultural wisdom. Animals just are instinctual and genetically driven, and there's nothing else going on. When in fact, that's not the case. There's cultural wisdom in animals, in species. And so losing a species is not just losing a genetic resource, and that's bad enough. You know, you lose the genetics, but you also lose the cultural wisdom. So that's a real reason to protect animals, like a cultural reason. Who'd have thought we'd be talking about animal cultures? But that's very much the discussion now. So we can take that where we want.
Where did the wolves come from that were reintroduced to Yellowstone?
Canada.
Were they wild?
Canada.
Yeah.
Canada?
And there must have been a learning curve for them too.
Yeah.
But they're so smart, you know, wolves are so smart.
Well, I was just thinking, well, they were sheep.
Well, and I suppose we have lifespans of, what, 7 or 8 years for a wolf? And so the generational repeat, you know, while it might not be like a peak ride, it's so quick.
Yeah.
It's certainly quicker than moose.
Yeah, and probably the social structure helps for wolves too. Yeah, you know, they have such an involved social structure. They are probably very good at passing on knowledge culturally in a way that other animals might not be.
I think what you're saying there too, Christopher, ties into nurturing. So nearly every species, the mother will nurture the young for some period of time before that young is sent out to the world. So at that point they are teaching.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that still seems to support the idea that the reason that humans are more successful at all of this is based on cultural wisdom. But our cultural wisdom can transmit in more effective ways. Doesn't mean that there is no cultural wisdom elsewhere, but it shows the importance of it in our species too. So this guy who says that, you know, we have libraries and communication, and that's the reason that we are so successful, I mean, that essentially still holds true.
Yeah, and, you know, we are pretty good at sharing information. I mean, honestly, I mean, as much as one might admire the moose wisdom and the bighorn sheep wisdom, you do have to admire the human wisdom for accumulating, sharing, passing on.
Yeah, if you look in the Olympics at figure skating back in the 1950s, somebody would win a gold medal for doing whip roll. I mean, that was, now you have people, and it's not because the people currently are more physically fit or smarter. It's, I believe, the wisdom that has been passed along. Once you know how to do this, then you can add, you can instruct your student how to do more and more and more.
Yeah.
Add the one thing to that, that's the Lamarckian change. It's no longer random. Like the old saying, random mutation, natural selection, is now completely subsumed. We don't worry about being killed by wolves. That would be natural selection. And so the difference is we write books, we think about them, we reason them through, and we write books, and then that becomes a part of the genetics of the culture, which is Lamarckian rather than Darwinian. So that's my point.